Thank you. Be seated. We were having a little bit of difficulty hearing the attorneys earlier today. So if you'll speak up, they've improved our air conditioning system, but now we're hearing the air conditioning system, not who we need to be hearing. So just keep that in mind if you're a soft speaker. Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Brandon Vicker versus the state of Texas. Commit me to court. Good having light on the public appellate, Mr. David Vicker.
Yes.
First off, I just want to say, while one witness may be legally sufficient to convict, however, the evidence must be sufficient that a rational trier of fact can conclude the state's proof in this case. In this case, the testimony of the named victim, J.M., conflicted with statements she previously made to other witnesses, which were put in the record. At trial, J.M. testified that she screamed during alleged assault, but that her mother never heard. Previously, J.M. had told the examining nurse, Fugate, that J.M. kicked the appellant and that her mother knocked on the door and didn't meet the incident. A.H., the mother, did not testify to either of these. These two stories cannot both be true. One of them did not happen. The state knew this going into the trial. Also of significance is the timing of J.M.'s outcry. It was coming only after A.H., the mother, had been arrested for assaulting Mr. Riker. The form of the outcry is also due to this. And that J.M. initially said that the touching occurred over the clothes, and only after Yolanda Johnson started to wind down the interview did J.M. add that the touching occurred under the clothes, as if the escalation was needed to push the case forward, push the outcry forward. To explain the significant changes in J.M.'s testimony, the state focused on J.M.'s statements of empowerment. Basically, the state called a witness, Ms. Shercliffe, whose purpose was to explain why J.M.'s story would change and would not make sense. Yet the jury should still convict, even with her conflicting story. The state in argument went so far as to basically acknowledge that J.M. was not telling the truth. And she, when J.M. described the incident, the state asked the jury to let J.M. have her inconsistencies. The jury should still be there. The rational juror should wonder, the screaming is not true, what else is not true? If the knocking on the door is false, are other claims wrong? If the fighting did not happen, did the touching not happen? Is this story provable beyond a reasonable doubt? Beyond a reasonable doubt, not probable cause. Here, apparently, the state did not feel they even had probable cause to draw appellant's blood to test him for the battery of sexually transmitted diseases that J.M. was tested for. Had the state felt their probable cause, it would have been. To bolster J.M.'s claims, the state started from the start, use the allegation that appellant, Mr. Riker, gave J.M. chlamydia. Right from the start to finish, from opening statement to closing argument, few things are more offensive and disturbing than a 7-year-old infected with a sexually transmitted disease. Yet the state went down this road with no credible evidence that appellant was the sort of J.M., the source of J.M.'s infection. When we go through the timeline, which is in my brief, when questioned by Yolanda Johnson, A.H. mentions only that she had herpes from appellant. That was in August. In September, Fugate discovers that J.M. has chlamydia, but she does not discover herpes. There is a battery of tests. November 2016, Detective Brian arrested appellant. It was only on July 25th, eve of trial, when A.H. finally tells, coincidentally, the district attorney's office that she had chlamydia from the appellant. And significantly, when testifying, the appellant testifies he does not know if he has chlamydia. He's never been tested, but he does concede the other ones. Everyone agrees he had herpes, but he's never been tested for chlamydia. The only evidence that he had chlamydia is the recently remembered useful testimony of A.H. that she received chlamydia from the appellant. But there's nothing to support that other than her groundless claim. A blood test would have shown definitively whether he had chlamydia, whether he had herpes, whether the child had herpes, whether the child had chlamydia. These were shown. The child had chlamydia, not herpes. The state cites numerous cases to show that a jury can rely on a single witness to convict. The jury can believe some, none, or all of the witnesses' testimony. But I want to focus on the nature of the evidence in this case. That's different than that. One of the sexual assault cases that they cite, the evidence is the child says, I was penetrated. The doctor says, no evidence of penetration. Well, the penetration is inherent in the crime. It's a necessary element of the offense. And what does the Court of Appeals and the Court of Criminal Appeals says, that's fine, the jury can believe the child in that case, they don't have to believe the expert testimony. Or you have the other extreme where you have an assault case where one witness testifies that there's a gun. That's enough. The nature of the evidence here is fundamentally different. The evidence was that we had a child whose story changed. They knew the child's story changed and was going to change, so they called an expert witness essentially to say, of course the child's story is going to change. Knowing that that was a major problem with their case, they put on this unsubstantiated evidence of basically another bad act. But a bad act that would be directly tied to the case that the defendant gave the child chlamydia without any support. When that accusation is thrown out, it's very hard to deny. It's very hard to say, no, I didn't. And in fact, in this case, when the defendant did testify, he was basically called a liar. If he has herpes, he must have chlamydia. It's similar, as I say in my brief, when did you stop beating your wife? You can't really answer that if you've never been. And I'd like to add, this sort of evidence, if they've proven that the defendant had chlamydia, if they've proven that the defendant infected the girl with chlamydia, that's case over. That's proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt, without a question. But they don't do that. They're relying on conjecture.
Do they have to have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt on a non-essential fact?
I don't believe they do, but they relied on it throughout their argument. The trial counsel says, we know her story's not true, let's get that to her. Here's how you can be confident that he molested her, she has chlamydia. And the evidence of that is truly new evidence, week before trial. Not 2 years before trial. So what you have to do here, we're looking at what a rational juror would do. The problem with something like a sexually transmitted disease, it's emotional, it carries a significant social stigma. If people have cancer, they'll acknowledge it. If people have a cold, broken leg, There's not a social stigma associated with that as compared to a person who's got a sexually transmitted disease. So they throw that out there. It's upsetting to a jury, clearly. Without evidence. And the points that they draw upon to show, oh, this is proof, they say you can't transmit it other than through sexual intercourse. And minutes later on cross-examination, the nurse says, well, you can't get it through trial. So there's at least...
I don't see any authority here for the proposition, not as to whether or not the evidence should be admitted because it's, you know, unduly prejudicial, but the question is somehow it becomes legally insufficient because there was unduly prejudicial evidence admitted. That's kind of the essence of what I'm seeing. Do you have any authority that says that? Okay.
I'm relying merely on the Jackson v. Virginia.
Right.
Basically, that they have given them something that is so toxic, basically you're on.
Okay.
Or your summation.
Okay.
Which is that if you throw something out there like this, there's no without that you can't support. While conceding that this is your silver bullet, because we really can't trust what the child has to say, because the child's testimony is changeable in significant ways. Whether the touching was over the clothes or under the clothes, whether she screamed or whether she didn't, whether her mother came in or whether her mother did not come in. Those are significant, and really, truly, the most significant is over the clothes or under the clothes. The state goes in knowing that. The state goes in knowing that they've got the witness, who they don't really feel comfortable resting the case upon. If they did, they would have just put her on and that would have been the end of it. But they don't do that. They put on a series of witnesses to try to bolster, from the detective to the nurse to the child advocacy center. All to say, oh, well, we believe she's telling the truth. Well, what part of her story is the truth? And that's why the state continually goes back to, well, the child has a disease. The child has a disease, which if Mr. Reichert had that disease, that's beyond his belief.
If you didn't have the evidence of chlamydia at all, no sexually transmitted disease information at all, would you still argue the evidence is insufficient under Jackson? Because isn't the jury allowed to consider conflicting testimony and decide what they believe and what they don't believe? And we're not supposed to disturb that?
I would tell you that even without it, you still have a problem with this information. Because the state comes forth and says, we know her story's not true. That's why Shirkland testifies. But further evidence that they know that there's problems with...
Well, they don't say that the entire story isn't true. They say, they admit that there are certain parts of the story that aren't true.
That's true.
And so they don't admit away the essential testimony that this crime occurred, just some of the statements tangential to that. And well, I don't want to use the word tangential, some of the statements related to that. And isn't that just bald statement that it happened enough under the law and under Jackson and under the statute to the uncorroborated testimony of a victim of sex offenses is sufficient? Right, well, her statement has changed, and that goes to impeachment. But don't you think it would pass muster, even just taking the sexual transmitted disease out of it?
Well, that'd be a different case, wouldn't it? We have that.
But it doesn't matter. If it passes muster under Jackson without the sexually transmitted disease, then the sufficiency is there, right?
The issue is that we've got, and it's nice to say, well, the jury has been instructed to Well, there's no jury instruction saying don't consider sexually transmitted disease. They're allowed to consider all the evidence. It's hard for us to go in and say what evidence they considered or what evidence they didn't consider. But the fact is they had that. That was central to the state's case. The state knew they had a weak case, and therefore they throw out this bomb. They lock this into the jury box. The jury can't sort this out this way. They're under the emotional state. Which understandably anybody would be. And that's why we're asking you as, not as the 13th juror, but as the rational juror, to sit here, look at the evidence, and conclude whether there's sufficient evidence to believe this child was molested by Mr. Weidman. And I think when you consider all of the evidence, and even cherry-picking, the state's key witness is wholly inconsistent from start to finish. And knowing that, the state goes on and throws out this, you know, unsubstantiated, highly toxic thing. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Mr. White is a very good attorney. A very good argument this morning. But it was a jury argument. It really was not a good appellate argument. Jackson v. Virginia, 1979 Supreme Court case, and the evidence in the light must bear the verdict, and any testimony favorable to the defense were to disregard. So all of the argument relating to the inconsistencies in the victim's testimony and this issue about the sexually transmitted disease are unimportant, because the elements of the offense the state was required to prove are set forth in the indictment. And nothing in the indictment requires the jury to find that the appellant gave the victim a sexually transmitted disease. Now, the state did say, and I think it was a reasonable inference, that he did. There's no doubt that the victim had. The mother said that the defendant had given her chlamydia. And yes, there was a very contentious relationship between the mother and the appellant. I think she was even arrested for assaulting the appellant. So the theory of defense at trial was that the child was trying to endear herself to her mother by making up this story. But the jury, not this court, got to see the witnesses. The jury, not this court, got to view their demeanor. The appellant testified, the complainant testified, and the mother testified. So the jury got to hear all of the testimony, including the inconsistent statements by each of the witnesses, got to view their demeanor, and determine beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant had in fact committed this offense. And that really ends it. You view the evidence in light most favorable to the verdict and disregard the evidence favorable to the defense, then the evidence here was clearly sufficient. One witness, if believed, is sufficient to prove a sexual assault. And we had the witness, the child, testify. Were there inconsistencies? Yes. Had this court ever seen sexual assault of a child case where a young victim wasn't inconsistent on one fact or another? I don't think this court has ever seen that. There were inconsistencies in this case, but the thrust of the defense concerning the chlamydia, even if chlamydia is somehow had to be proven or was a bomb, as the appellant said, thrown into the jury box, that kind of language is normally used when the appellant is trying to prevent that evidence from coming in at trial, an objection to an extraneous offense because it's overly prejudicial. The evidence here, Judge, as you pointed out, is a legal sufficiency challenge. That's completely different than an extraneous offense challenge. So if the appellant is complaining about the introduction of that evidence, the objection on appeal and in the trial court should have been the trial court improperly allowed the state to introduce prejudicial testimony that was either not relevant or that the probative effect was outweighed by its prejudicial effect. That would be the objection, but that's not the objection. The objection is really a legal sufficiency challenge. As far as the jury and this issue of chlamydia, the testimony was that chlamydia is treated with zithromycin, In fact, there's testimony that a single dose of this marcipan can clear it up. The question then became, well, if we had tested the appellant for whether he had chlamydia, that still doesn't answer the question. If he had chlamydia, had he been given zithromycin or an antibiotic, and would he show evidence of it? And the nurse said she wasn't sure whether the antigens for chlamydia would somehow be present after a person is treated with the antibiotic zithromycin. So even if he had been tested, and also, not to get into the weeds here, but the objection at trial or the complaint on trial about the chlamydia was that the appellant had never, there had never been a search warrant for the defendant's blood. But the testimony at trial, at least the testimony the state introduced, said you don't test blood for chlamydia, you test urine for chlamydia, or the tip of the penis for semen. You don't get it from a blood test. So everything was kind of thrown out. I mean, it was like a plate of spaghetti against the wall in trial court, as criminal trials sometimes are. That was part of the plate of spaghetti, and it didn't stick. The jury didn't, obviously, didn't consider that something that caused them to have a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt, because they did find him guilty. They found him guilty of two things. They found him guilty of contact from his sexual organ to the victim's sexual organ, and then they found that he had digitally penetrated the victim's sexual organ with his finger. Well, the finger penetration doesn't have anything to do with chlamydia, and as I said, the contact between his sexual organ and the complainant's sexual organ, that was clearly established that the jury wanted to believe the victim because that's what she testified to. No doubt, that's what she testified to. The defendant didn't, on appeal, doesn't say she didn't provide that testimony, just that she shouldn't be believed because of these other inconsistencies in the testimony. And that's what Jackson versus Virginia says. Any inconsistency, that's a question for the jury, not an appellate court, because we don't have the ability to look and listen to the testimony and view the demeanor of the child when she testifies, or view the demeanor of the defendant when he testifies. That's within the jury's province. So I think, again, this argument that he presents is well presented, but it's a well presented jury argument, and we're past that point. So we would ask that under all of the evidence in this case, this court find that a rational trier of fact could have believed the child and disbelieved the defendant and all of the evidence favorable to the defendant, such that the jury's verdict should be upheld. We'll ask the court to do it. Thank you.
The nature of this evidence, the nature of the testimony, is such that it impairs a person's ability to look at it rationally. Having, and the state knew this through their argument. The state knew that their case was not as strong as it could. Consequently, went to rely on this unproven sexually transmitted disease. I would say, and I don't want to get into a antigens or antigens. So if you're testing for antigens, you would have to do that.
So where is that explanation in the record?
It's not. And I'll concede that. But I mean, that is the antigens are. Left over parts of our blood system that fight. Those remain. So And that does go to the sufficiency of the evidence, I believe. The state chose, if the state had chosen merely to rely on the child, then I think the complexion of the history would be very different, but they didn't. And it's not really appropriate for the state to be able to throw out all sorts of unproven, unprovable, or allegations that they chose not to make any effort to investigate and prove, and then say, well, it's okay now because the jury got to hear from the child, and that's enough. And that's essentially what you want. The child is fully inconsistent. The child cannot keep her story straight. The child, they have the expert witness to explain why the child's story is going to change, why we should believe what the state wants us to believe, which is that it's all happened, not that it didn't happen. They could have testified to, because your initial outcry was no assault, really no other touching, which might be an indecency, but it's not an aggravated sexual assault. So what I'm going to do is just close by saying, if the evidence were so clear that the child had been molested, that a rational juror could find it beyond a reasonable doubt, without this extra thumb on the scale of an unproven claim of sexually transmitted disease, the state would have done that. But they knew a rational juror couldn't do that, so they had to throw that out, thereby pushing the jury from, I think, from rational to not being rational.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument today. That does conclude our hearings for today. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business. Thank you.